This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, some new hope for migrants in Europe. The United States urged to take a more active role. A wet forecast for a very dry area.
This looks very, very promising for a down payment on drought relief in the American West. We're very hopeful for this El Nino.
A Canadian Indian singer finds a way to really turn on the light. These stories and more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. Both France and Britain have agreed to accept thousands of refugees from the war-torn Mideast, but the numbers are dwarfed by the masses of migrants streaming to new lives in Germany. French President François Hollande said his country would accept 24,000 refugees over the next 2 years. British Prime Minister David Cameron announced that 20,000 Syrian refugees from camps in Turkey, Jordan, and Syria would settle in Britain over the next 5 years. He said vulnerable children and orphans would be given priority. Europe is struggling to cope with the continent's biggest migrant crisis since World War II. Hungary is at the forefront of trying to block their passage to much wealthier Germany and Scandinavian countries. Germany says that 800,000 refugees looking to escape war and poverty in their homelands could settle in the country by the end of the year. VOA correspondent Luis Ramirez is in Budapest, where he's been monitoring the influx of refugees and spoke with International Edition's Susan Yaki about the crisis.
What is happening is that with Hungary lifting many of the restrictions that it had imposed on the refugees, word is getting back to those who are at the earlier stages of this pipeline. What I am hearing from the border now is I just got off the phone with a Hungarian relief worker who is helping deal with the influx. He described a very dire situation as people are hearing of the assured passage through Hungary. They're deciding to make the trip. Some have been holding in Macedonia. Some have been in Serbia. They're making their way toward Hungary. The Hungarian government has said it is reinforcing its border controls. There is a fence with razor-sharp wire that exists there. The government said that it will repair the holes in which many of these refugees have been using to cross. Others have been using railroad track, rail lines, to come from Serbia into Hungary. And so that is a situation that the Hungarian government is very much bracing for. On the other end, you have Austria, which has been receiving the migrants very efficiently, taking them from the trains that they're arriving from in Vienna, and putting them onto trains bound for Germany, where many of the migrants tell me is, in fact, where they want to go.
And how can they handle all these people? What supplies are there for them?
There's been an incredible outpouring of goodwill donations on the part of private citizens. The government has also been facilitating matters in that they've installed water faucets. There are washing facilities. There are signs pointing them to where they need to go to catch the train to the border. But mainly it's private relief organizations, private individuals showing up with bags of food, offering assistance. There are even people driving into Budapest, both from within Hungary and also people from the Czech Republic who I talked to, who are driving their private cars and offering transportation to the border. Now, this is a situation that the Hungarian government has warned people against. They are warning people that the law does not allow private citizens to transport people who are undocumented across Hungarian territory. Nonetheless, the people I spoke to, the volunteers, said that when they hear the news reports of the suffering of these refugees, they cannot help but come and do whatever they can personally to ease what they see as purely a matter of human suffering.
And Luis, many of these people would really rather be at home than be in this situation going to another country.
I've interviewed dozens of refugees in the days that I've been here, Susan, and I can tell you that not one has said that he or she is happy making this trip. Every single one has said, if things were okay in Syria, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, I would be home. That's what I'm getting consistently from people. There's also some expressions of frustration and anger on why the United States is not doing more to end the fighting in Syria. They said that if the fighting in Syria, as one example, were to end, there would be absolutely no reason to leave their country.
VOA correspondent Luis Ramirez in Budapest speaking with International Edition's Susan Yaki. The head of the International Rescue Committee is appealing to the United States to do more to help Europe cope with its migration crisis. Former British Labour Party leader David Miliband suggests the United States should take about half the UN-recommended 130,000 Syrians resettled throughout the world by the end of 2016. Associate Professor Jonathan Adelman of the University of Denver told International Audition's Victor Beatty there will be little European Union leaders can do about the Syrian conflict when they meet to discuss migration September 14th in Brussels.
The Bashar Assad regime has now killed, by one estimate, 240,000 civilians. And then on the other side, there's the horrors of ISIS. And so the Europeans, I don't think, can do much or intend to do much about that, a little bit. But I think what they can do is help deal with this really great tragedy that we're seeing today. And we need to remember one other thing, that the numbers are staggering, that Syria has a population of about 22, 23 million. And of them, over 4 million of them are now living in other Arab countries or Turkey right next door, and 7 other million have been displaced within Syria. So we have one of the great tragedies of the modern era, and thus far, the West has not been able to develop the means to put an end to this conflict.
Will all of these migrants, some of them coming from the Middle East, others from South Asia, elsewhere, will they change the face of Europe?
Well, I don't think in the short run. The face of Europe, after all, is about 500 million people, of which 440 million are in the European Union. But if millions more come, then it's quite possible, together with the migrants who have already had a major impact. So I think down the road, this is a really difficult problem for the Europeans. And for the Germans, because they have 80 million people in their population, and they have, of course, the tragic history of World War II, they now, under Angela Merkel, are willing to take a substantial number of these, and they have the capacity to do it. But many of the other European countries, like the Greeks, for example, don't want to do this because not just because of their attitudes, but for the simple reason that they have deep economic problems of their own.
How long can this go on before anti-immigrant sentiment begins to rise in the EU?
It's already starting, and it's going to get much worse. Because the problem is that Bashar Assad is still holding on in Syria to Damascus, to most of Aleppo, to Latakia, which is his Alawite stronghold. He's got the big cities on his side, and he doesn't mind killing another few hundred thousand people. And the West has not really intervened effectively. You know, the United States said, oh, we're going to train Syrians, and that was a noble idea. And the recent study that came out before Congress said that we've actually trained less than 100, and a third of them have already been taken captive. So we face some really significant problems of our own. How much do we want to get involved with this? ISIS is just not going away. ISIS is actually expanding. And they are occupying over a third of Syria and over a third of Iraq and posing a tremendous trouble and tremendous problem when we get down to the decapitation and enslavement of large numbers of people who haven't fled. So this is a great tragedy all the way around.
David Miliband, the former UK labor leader, is now head of the International Rescue Mission. He was on U.S. television Sunday saying the U.S. should do more to ease the European migrant crisis.
It's a possibility, but I don't think so. Right now, the United States is taking about 1,500 of these migrants. We have very strict laws because we have our own issues in terms of the million people we take every year, in terms of the illegals for about 11 million and so forth. And thus far, I think until we saw that picture of that poor three-year-old child, you know, that had now been killed, and most of the rest of his family. So maybe we'll begin to see some change in American perception. But right now, it just hasn't been sufficient enough that the administration or Congress has really gotten involved. I think the Europeans are going to come and ask the United States to get involved, but I have no idea right now that there's enough pressure, especially during presidential election season, where many other things are on people's mind.
Associate Professor Jonathan Edelman of the University of Denver in Colorado, speaking with International Edition's Victor Beatty. While the term migrant is being used to describe the massive wave of people moving from Africa and the Middle East into Europe, many have fled military conflicts. International Edition's Jeffrey Young turned to Joel Millman, spokesperson for the International Organization for Migration, to ask him for a definition of who is a migrant and who is a refugee, along with the difficulties of classification in relocation status.
We started out by discussing an EU rule called the Dublin Regulation, which says that refugees and asylum seekers must register in the first EU country they reach, and why that rule is not working under the weight of so many coming to the EU's borders.
Countries have been sort of at loggerheads with each other over this all year. Germany and, I believe, Czech Republic have both indicated that it's time to put it aside, at least during this current humanitarian emergency. It's been a way for countries north of the Mediterranean littoral to complain about the countries like Greece and Italy that take the migrants first, because they say, well, why are you not processing them and making them stay to do their asylum? And the answer has been, well, first of all, we're overwhelmed, and second of all, they don't want to be here. They want to be with family members in your countries. So at IOM, we were quite happy that someone stepped up and said maybe it's time to put that regulation aside, because it's just obviously impractical for this number of people that are crossing. And what's more, it's giving Europe sort of a red herring excuse to talk about why they can't make progress, because first of all, let's get our border in order and let's make the rules work. That's not to say it's a bad idea, it's just it's not suited for something, an emergency like this with this many people.
So the people understand the difference. How do you discern who is a refugee seeking asylum and who is a migrant, someone who is just moving about looking for economic opportunity? What's the definition?
Well, there's a legal definition of actually of both, but refugee, the most important definition is that you must cross an international frontier, you must be fleeing conflict or distress. You cannot be someone, for example, dislodged by an earthquake or something like that. It really has to be related to some kind of armed conflict or forced displacement frontier, so you can't be an internally displaced person and claim to be a refugee. There are those who think everyone should be called a refugee, but at IOM what we say is refugee is a subset of migrant, and just as asylum seeker is a subset of refugee. We point out that there are many, many people who start out as job seekers and then things happen to them. They become victims of trafficking, you know, along the way. And then in extreme cases, they could easily be considered refugees, further up the chain. The other thing that's important to remember is that asylum seeker, someone, a subset of the refugee, is not necessarily someone fleeing a country like Syria that's got a declared war, you know, and that the world community takes as someone by definition a refugee because they come from certain countries. We like migrant because it covers the wide range of people that we consider our constituency.
Joel Millman of the International Organization for Migration speaking with International Edition's Jeffrey Young. Economic concerns are an overriding factor as Europe copes with a massive influx of refugees. According to Jacob Kierkegaard, a scholar at the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington, they could eventually be good for the economy of Germany and some other nations. Mr. Kierkegaard says there are significant short-term cost of feeding, housing, and giving language training to newcomers. He says Germany and some other European nations have aging populations and need a renewed workforce to continue economic growth. Some other economists have been questioning whether Europe's economy can even sustain the rapid influx. VOA's Andrew Parshevsky is following social media trends and tells us now what's getting strong reaction. Andrew?
Well, this migrant story continues to trend as they make their way. And the term that's trending right now is 20,000 Syrians. And this is because the UK has said they will take in 20,000 Syrians by 2020. So that announcement's making a lot of waves on social media. A lot of people saying it's great that the UK is taking this step. Other people saying it's not enough. So it's a back and forth on social media about that, and people waiting to see what other countries will jump in. I know there have been announcements by Germany and other countries welcoming these migrants in. Australia said they want to help out. We talked about on the earlier show about the candlelight vigils, a lot of sympathy for the migrants there, and seeing if perhaps the U.S. will take them in or other countries maybe in the West. The other big story trending today is Superhenge. Stonehenge, of course, the big stone monument in the UK. Well, they found one, they're unearthing one that they said is massive in scale, 100 stones, and it's only about 3 kilometers from Stonehenge, so it's right nearby, but they're saying that there might be more things buried underground. So that's being talked about a lot, saying what else are they going to find as they dig down near around Stonehenge, and what else will they find?
Thanks, Andrew. You can find us on social media. Follow our Twitter account at @VOA_IE. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, the host for Jazz America, where each week we give you the best of jazz past and present and conversation with the music makers. You can hear the program online at voanews.com and on the air on VOA each Saturday and Sunday at 13 hours Universal Time. Join me for Jazz America and help me celebrate the greatness of a century of jazz. Listen at 13 hours Universal Time Saturdays and Sundays on voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Much of the western part of the United States is experiencing extreme drought conditions that are helping to cause wildfires and water shortages. But scientists are predicting some weather changes that will not only impact the American West, but parts of Asia, Australia, and Africa. Elizabeth Lee has details from Los Angeles.
And then this is mugwort. You can see that it's got very different leaves.
As the drought continues for another year in Southern California, more and more people, including Jan Muntz, are replacing all or parts of their yards with unconventional garden plants.
It's very painful. And some of these plants have been there probably 80 and 90 years.
Many of the plants in the Los Angeles area are not native and require lots of water. The Theodore Payne Foundation, through its nursery, has been trying to promote and educate people about California native plants for decades. In the last several years, there has been dramatic increase in the number of people who are interested, says the foundation's Kitty Connolly.
You use less water. So in a California native garden, depending on how you plant, you'll save 50 to 80% of water over a conventional garden.
A lack of water may not be a problem this coming winter, says climatologist Bill Patzert.
This looks very, very promising for a down payment on drought relief in the American West. We're very hopeful for this El Nino.
El Nino refers to a situation of warmer than average waters in the equatorial Pacific. Scientists expect a big one to hit toward the end of 2015 and into 2016. But El Nino impacts go beyond the United States.
Some areas that are normally dry, like the American West, Peru and Ecuador, get torrential rains. In Southeast Asia, Indonesia and the Philippines and Northern Australia, they get punishing droughts. Even in South Africa, they get droughts. And so there isn't one continent that doesn't feel the footprint of a big El Nino.
While El Nino lasts for about a year, another weather pattern in the works could last much longer. It's called the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, or PDO. It tends to show patterns of warming or cooling that would last for years or decades, says research scientist Nate Mantua in a Skype interview.
The warm pattern of the PDO favors above normal rainfall in Southern California and throughout the southwest part of the U.S. and northern Mexico. So it would favor a break in these dry conditions for the southwest.
Weather, Mantua says, is unpredictable. And in the last two big El Niños, there were quick transitions to cold conditions and a shift in the PDO pattern. So one possibility, the southwestern U.S. may only get 1 year of rain.
This grows next to water.
Back at the Theodore Payne Foundation's nursery, where people are learning to garden with California native plants, they say rain or drought, their yard will be prepared with plants that can probably handle whatever Mother Nature brings their way. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
Coming up, music that's truly enlightening. This is VOA.
This is Greenbeat for a healthier planet.
How to create a better solar cell.
Perovskite.
Say again?
Perovskite. So I think the biggest breakthrough here at Northwestern and at the Answer Center, and I would boldly also claim in solar energy research, is the renaissance of this new material called perovskite.
Dick Coe is the director of operations at the Argonne Northwestern Solar Energy Research Center. Coe says the mineral perovskite might help lower cost in solar cell manufacturing.
You can spray paint this like inkjet printing, like how we print newspapers, to make solar cells that are now as efficient as the silicon solar panel.
Coe says implementation of these third generation solar cells could be just a few years away.
We'll see them in appliances and consumer electronics where these technologies are better at absorbing diffuse light.
The Answer Center is an energy frontier research center funded by the U.S. Department of Energy. Its focus, says Coe, is to find ways to make solar energy less expensive and more efficient. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
This is VOA's International Edition. Canadian Indian singer Raghav Mathur describes his music as unabashedly pop, but recently his song called Until the Sun Comes Up has been used to raise awareness of the needs of the developing world, especially in Africa. VOA's David Byrd takes a look at the song and how it changed the lives of some Tanzanian schoolchildren and the singer.
Been so long, I'm waiting on you, baby, but I can feel it in the air tonight.
If you listen to the words of Canadian crooner Raghav's song Until the Sun Comes Up, you might think it is just another dance-based pop tune. You wouldn't know it is helping to transform the lives of school children in a small African village.
Here we go tonight. Baby, you and I, we're the stars shining bright. It's just the two of us until the sun comes up.
Raghav says that when he learned that there are currently more than 1 billion people living in the world without electricity, he wanted to help.
That 1.3 billion people have no electricity. And so when I say that number, people often think, I mean to say a million. I mean, it's a sixth of the planet has zero electricity. And until you go there, and not just go there, but experience the, or hear the stories of the negative experiences through the kerosene industry, you can't really totally understand the impact.
So he teamed with Solar Aid, a nonprofit dedicated to eliminating the kerosene lamp, to distribute 320 solar-powered lights to school-age children in Tanzania. Raghav says he got the idea from watching an old YouTube video.
And they take a bucket of water and they put it in a village in like India or Bangladesh or somewhere, in what is clearly an impoverished village. And in it they've put a light. And I think at first people kind of look at it like, you know, what is this hanging around here? And throughout the YouTube video, you see people start coming up to it, playing with it, and the joy that it creates. And I thought, well, what a great way to depict joy if we could incorporate that in like a pop record.
The sun comes up. Here we go. Tonight. Yeah. Baby, you and I, we're the stars.
Raghav teamed with rapper Nelly and Bollywood star Abhishek Bachchan to film the reaction of the students when they received the lights. The singer says that the joy seen in the video is real. None of it was staged or choreographed.
Their idea of in their homes or in the school would have been the use of kerosene. And when the sun went down, that's the climax of the video. They kind of started partying without, it wasn't choreographed and it wasn't shot to be a music video. They just were having such a great time.
The 34-year-old Canadian singer says he hopes his song and the video will inspire other musicians to become socially active and aware. I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
That's it for this edition of International Edition. More news and information is at your fingertips when you click on voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is concerned about ongoing abuses of religious freedom in China. At a press briefing, Deputy Spokesperson Mark Toner cited as a recent example the detention of prominent Christian human rights lawyer Jiang Kai, who, with his assistants, was taken away by police on August 25th in the southeastern city of Guangzhou. A Beijing-based lawyer, Mr. Zhang, had been advising a number of Christian churches in their fight against a government campaign in Zhejiang province to remove crosses and demolish churches. Reportedly, he is now facing up to 6 months in secretive detention on suspicion of threatening state security and creating a disturbance. The detention of Mr. Zhang demonstrates that China's crackdown on human rights lawyers and its repression of religious freedom is continuing. U.S. Ambassador-at-Large for International Religious Freedom, David Saperstein, recently traveled to China to discuss religious freedom with Chinese government officials, religious leaders, and civil society representatives. The State Department reported that Ambassador Saperstein noted some positive developments in China, including the growth of religious communities in the country and a significant increase in the contributions of faith-based organizations to Chinese society. But the State Department noted that Ambassador Saperstein also raised a number of concerns regarding the Chinese government's human rights violations pertaining to religious freedom. He called for an end to the ongoing campaign of cross removals and church demolitions in Zhejiang province and an end to harassment of members of unregistered religious groups. He urged Chinese authorities to reassess counterproductive policies, including restrictions on the religious practice of Tibetan Buddhists and Uyghur Muslims. In addition, the State Department reported that Ambassador Saperstein conveyed the U.S. government's deep concern over the recent detention of many human rights defenders and religious leaders. The United States wants to see Jiang Kai released, along with all Chinese citizens who are being detained and persecuted because of their exercise of the fundamental human rights of freedom of religion, expression, and assembly. China, like all nations, must recognize that protecting and promoting those freedoms make up the foundation of every stable, prosperous, and just society.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. We'll be right back.
is 4.